Are we recording? It's the things are doing this.
I think that means it's recording. Okay, is that all right? There, that's not going to go anywhere, right? Okay, it's still bumping.
Does the light flash if you talk about it?
The light means the microphone is active on this side. It's the red light means that the camera's on kind of deal.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead. Do your thing.
I apparently am the moderator. This is Game Development 101, or you're here because you have suffered a mental lapse and want to develop games. I think we should, introduce ourselves. My name is Greg Porter. I run a small game company called BTRC about an hour south of here. I do my own role-playing titles. I also do some board games and freelance work for other people. I'm, for instance, tomorrow I'll be demoing a playtest version of Zombie War, which is a zombie board game I'm doing for Lock and Load.
Cool. I'm Brandon Blackmore. I contributed to a couple of Small Press role-playing games in the early 90s. I'm one of the people who founded Small Game Publishers Association, which then became the Game Publishers Association after I left. I've written various things not for profit, like Under the Broken Moon, the Thunder of the Barbarian role-playing game, for anybody who remembers Thunder of the Barbarian, which is available on DVD now. Awesome. I currently work for DriveThruRPG / RPG Now, which is the main PDF retailer for role-playing game stuff. Something that I was trying to push small game publishers into back in 1995, and nobody wanted to do it.
Except me.
Awesome! Ahead of your time, as always. And, yeah. So, I think that's everything important about me.
My name is John Maher. I'm a graphic designer, and I've, played in a number of different games, but I wrote a couple of articles, game articles for Privateer Press magazine.
Awesome.
So we have people here who everyone's got some of the design aspect. You're on the RPG Now side. You got the graphic design side, and I'm almost exclusively on the design side. So I think we have a nice field here.
Where's the WotC guy? I thought we were gonna go WotC guy.
They'll get fired by Hasbro.
How are we going to find out how to sell out and make a million?
Several million. Now he's off busy prepping for Gen Con. But anyway, why are you here at the panel?
Well, I'm currently working on a couple of board game and card game designs. And I also run a designers forum, a meetup group, Northern Virginia Game Designers, where I'm trying to get people together just for playtesting of those kinds of games, just to, because we have meetups for just game nights. And I met a lot of people who are interested in designing games, and I said, well, I have one meetup. I'll do another one that lets people get together specifically for testing out other people's game designs.
That's really cool, and it's really amazing to me how many people are willing to spend their own time testing and playing something that somebody else wrote. Because one of the things that first, before I actually was a contributor to anything, a company I was affiliated with back in the very early 90s called Escape Adventures, they did a game called Gate War that I contributed to that you've never heard of. And but their main deal, as far as like most of what they spent their time doing, was playtesting. Escape Adventures basically went to Gen Con and signed up people to be playtesters, and then a company would come, somebody like you, essentially, somebody who wanted other people to playtest their game. And this is really before the internet took off, right? I mean, there was email, but there wasn't even a World Wide Web at that point. Just email and Gopher and Archie and that kind of thing. Essentially, would pay Escape Ventures and then give them the game, and Escape Ventures would use their network of normal people
playtesters, right,
to playtest the game and then send in. And that was like the big thing. Of course, now you get the internet and the
sure.
web, and well, there's no need to pay anybody for that anymore. But the willingness of people.
Yeah.
Out there to play test other people's games, I've always thought that was amazing.
Well, and also the willingness of a designer to participate in that unknown. Recently responded to a form request in Board Game Geek. I'm looking for playtesters. He's printing his game on Game Crafter. He sent me a free copy, and all he needed in response was criticism, critiques, comments, whatnot. I got three other people together. We played a couple times. We sent him a long email, and he said, great, keep the game for free. So,
awesome.
It's like helping somebody bring something new into the world. So, that's why I'm here.
here because I'd like to make a game, mostly in the role-playing game field.
Okay. We can certainly help you out.
Or not. You know, devil's advocate. But if he helps, I have to talk you down.
Played a few role-playing games, and I'm just curious how they got to be where they were.
That's a really broad question. We'll get to that. No questions from you in the back. You look too weird.
I'm with him.
Okay. That would be what we call a war game widow.
Sometimes.
Oh, Drive-Thru RPG also does Drive-Thru War Games.
Yes.
Just like, okay, I got to plug the company. They're not.
Oh, no.
You guys also do comics, too.
We also do comics? Do you drive through horror? All kinds of crazy stuff.
I'm subscribed to Drive Through RPG's mailing list. So.
Yeah, everything that I sell is on RPG.
Nice.
Awesome.
So, I mean, awesome. I only do the download route. I don't do the three-tier distribution anymore.
We also sell games, so we're like invested in making sure that good stuff exists.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It kind of sucks for you because print media is dead.
Well, you know, but there's bits and mortar. Now, which is a company.
RPG just got their print on demand back online.
That's true. I was instrumental.
Good. So there's Bits and Mortar, which is companies can, when you, as a game store, you can sell somebody a physical copy of a book and give them a link to download the PDF.
That's cool.
So RPG Now, you download the PDF and they'll send you a card copy in the mail.
Right.
I mean,
so,
you know.
Yeah.
Plus, it's very hard to download a PDF of a board game.
I mean, actually, I'm trying to do that. I'm doing a steampunk supplement for EVA. It should be coming out next week. I still got to get the POD files set up. But, you know, it's going to be, you can order the download, or you can order the download, or you can order a hardback and get the download for, like, you know, $2 extra.
Right.
So, you know, so you get your choice.
All right, well, your turn to hawk something.
The stuff that I'm hawking is dealing with podcasts and audiobooks and stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I'm recording this.
Yes. Hello.
We'll see how it goes.
We'll see how much is lost in the editing.
Yes.
Hi. Bye. Okay, we're done.
You know, you never... Oh, I'm veering off. You're the moderator. You should rein us in.
Yeah.
You never know how often you say the word until you have to listen to yourself to put it online. Because apparently every third word I say is all. So I spent a two-hour game I ran last night, 15 minutes. The rest is all.
I've done that kind of thing.
The rest is thinking and silence.
I did an interview and I went through and I like removed all the extensive pauses and stutterings and and eventually by the end I could just tell where, you know, like, that's an Don't even have to listen. I know that's an I can see by the wavelengths. I recognized it.
Yeah, so... So do you have like a podcast website or something? What's your deal?
I have a podcast of the audiobook that I write.
Do you read it?
Yeah, I narrate. I'm a professional audiobook narrator as well.
Crazy. I was listening to James Marsters doing one of the Jim Butcher books. Mm-hmm. He's really good.
Yeah.
Are you really good?
Yes.
Yes, he is.
Oh, so you know?
Yes.
Are you available on like CD or DVD, or they can only download it?
You can download it, but free.
Well,
Tales
for
of the
now.
Website.
Yeah, cheap is good for you, is better.
Talesoftheleftand.com.
Awesome. What's your website going to call?
Well, it's btrc.net.
That's an awesome website.
No, it's not. It's a pretty crappy website.
No, actually, what I meant was this awesome URL, because it's like four letters. Yeah. And that's really
well, great. It's either that or Blacksburg Tactical Research Center. And it's
that's a cool URL.
Yeah, but btrc.net is better. Btrc.com is like some... company in India or something.
They probably make like plumbing supplies or something.
Yeah. But you were talking about board games. There are...
No, he's
role playing games.
He's board games, he's role playing.
No, he was talking about downloaded board games.
Oh, you can't.
You can't.
That's what he's saying.
Yes. It's not a very big market because, of course, there's the... you got to assemble it.
Yeah.
But you can do it. I mean, you know, after all, the files that go to a printer for a regular board game are electronic files. You just have to make them in a format that the average guy can print off and do something.
And apparently, okay, wargaming is not my deal, so if I say something wrong, you'll let me know.
Okay.
But apparently Drive-Thru Wargames, which I'm only tangentially aware of because I support the from the programming end, apparently they're doing really well. Because what you do is you print it and then you mount it on like foam core,
foam core or heavy, do it on heavy paper or something.
And then, ta-da, you've got a map.
There are a number of podcasts that exclusively deal with print and play games. They're called Print and Play.
Yeah.
I've got a couple titles like that. And
so you print the a map that would cover the table. You basically just send it in tile format. And you print the each page.
I've got one that's I redid a Black Death board game. Mm-hmm. That I had a while back. Nice new components. I mean, you print it off, it looks like something you would buy in the store. Like beautiful 15x20 map, counters, rules, the works.
Stand-ups?
No, it just uses regular counters. But the thing is, for doing it, there are a couple things you can cheat with. If you're trying to do like a card game, you do it on a format where you can print it on pre-perforated business card sheets. Because you can go to an office supply store and buy those. You don't have to worry about cutting everything out. You just print them off, bend it, fold it, and break it open.
That sounds good.
There's also, I don't know, but these things are getting sophisticated enough that you can play your board games. There is a Small World app where you play Small Worlds. You can play Carcassonne. It's the board game, and it's just, you download it.
Oh, for people who are listening, he's holding up a tablet. His is a
iPad.
iPad. Mine's a ViewSonic G Android tablet.
If you, I don't have a tablet, I'm sorry.
Pretend John has a tablet.
Luddite.
I have programs
tablet.
About the size.
Chiseled.
And sketch pads. So if, talking about board games that are played, on the tablet, mm-hmm. if you're playing it with other people, so you're all essentially looking at the same board.
Yeah, or you're like, I'm done my turn, you pass it to the next player.
Okay.
But Small World is, I believe, only a two-player implementation. But it's a fairly simple game, and it's a fairly low counter density. You just, move stuff around by... Mm-hmm. And Carcassonne is a tile placement game, so, a nice square grid, you just lay the things down. So, the sophistication goes up. I suspect, you're going to see more and more of that.
What does light green mean?
Staff.
Hi, Staff.
Yeah. I'm Alex.
Hi, Alex.
For those of you who don't already know me. I already
know Greg.
What are you thinking about doing a dump some sort of board game or design?
What?
Were you going to be doing some sort of design?
Trying to work on a role-playing game kind of concept.
Yeah, again, the easiest way to get into the market, it's getting increasingly crowded, is the RPG Now route, because there's no heavy overhead. You do not have to store crates of books in your garage. If you want to print off 10 copies for your friends, you just do it as a print on demand. It's getting harder and harder to be noticed because everyone and their cousin is in there. I mean, how many clients does RPG Now have?
Bazillions.
Several, at least 2,000.
I think at least several hundred, but I think it's well over 1,000. I haven't counted. Yeah. I just know whenever I go to the site and I want to find something and I scroll through all the publishers, because the publishers that I like are never in that small list that is the pre-selected for you list.
Yeah, because there's the ones who sell the most.
Well, it's the way it is.
Yeah, why do they sell the most? Because they're on that pre-selected list.
It's kind of a cart and the horse kind of a thing. But I click the all publishers, and I've got to scroll down like 80 times. So it's probably in the hundreds.
Yeah,
if
I'd been prescient, I would have named my company Aardvark Games, so it would be at the top of the list. But
that's brilliant. You have a good point as far as the barrier to entry is certainly lower now than it was when I started doing it in 1993. When I started doing it in 1993, you printed books.
You had to.
You spent, $15,000 of your own money to print books, and you stored them in your garage.
And if you sold them all, you made a profit of like $2,000 or $3,000.
If you were lucky. I had a guy ask me in the mid-90s how to get into game publishing. And I said, I'll tell you the secret to making a small fortune in game publishing. You start with a large fortune.
And I was going to use that joke, but I have a backup one. What's the difference between a game designer and a large pizza? A large pizza can feed a family of four.
But the barrier to entry is much, much lower now. And honestly, it's, there's tons of people who they've done their game, they put it online, and they probably, if they sold two copies, it's astonishing. But on the other hand, you get somebody who goes in, and for whatever reason, it just clicks. And it becomes like a thing for, you know, 2 months. And if you get other people to buy in and make supplements and things for it, then it might actually be self-sustaining. If not, you know, you had 15 minutes
back. There's a really big market for the D&D 3.5 supplements. Everyone in their cousin was doing it, right?
At one time.
Yeah.
Is that still true?
I don't know. Paizo is doing the Pathfinder. They're going gangbusters with that.
And it's a good product.
Yeah, I mean, they've also got it online as, you know, downloads and
yes.
stuff like that. So.
You can get the PDFs of the books. You know, I play Pathfinder myself, and I get the books, but I also get the PDFs because frequently the PDFs are all hyperlinked inside. So if you go to the index...
And also
always do that. And also
yeah.
they're updated.
Right, and they update them. So the errata are now, you know, eventually the PDF has all the edit, the errors fixed and things. And, you know, I like the game, and I think it works very well.
So if you have the money, get one of these or one of those. You carry your entire game, role-playing game collection on it.
Depending on the size of the collection, I can't fit all my
All the ones you will actually use.
Well, then again, I've got a lot of comic books on there, too. So.
Yeah. But, you know, and there's a PDF reader out there for the iPad called Dicebook. And it's just a PDF reader, but it's got a built-in custom dice roller in the PDF reader.
Oh, crazy.
So, you know, you just pull up a sidebar and go, I need to roll some dice. And it will roll any type of dice you want in any combination. And it's like, okay, you know, nice little niche product.
That is good. There's a ton of PDF readers for the Android tablets and dice rollers for the Android tablets. I'm not aware of something that does both, because I'm just not aware of something that does both, but that's pretty wacky.
There
what
is
that
a
called?
Dicebook. There's also one called PDF Expert, which is one of the best ones out there right now that actually will do forms and calculations in a PDF for the iPad anyway.
Can I ask John a question?
Yeah.
Graphic design, you mentioned at some point. So are you actually an artist, or are you more like a layout and aesthetics kind of guy?
More, it really depends on the project. I mean, I've done, like, did the logo for their company. Yeah. The t-shirt he's wearing is one of the, you know, I designed, those are some icons that were on his website and things. So
logo design is an underappreciated thing, but I'm actually talking about like artwork, like somebody standing there with a sword.
No, I wouldn't be drawing the sword.
Or the layout for a game.
I would do the layout for the game. I would choose the typography. You know, it's like basically I would, from my point of view, if somebody says, okay, I've got the game. I'm not really creating the game itself, but I might be working on, okay, how do you set up the game to attract the eye?
I mean, a lot of people have a good idea for a game. Of course, a lot of people have their, you know, I've been playing this D&D variant for 15 years.
Right.
And they set it up in a two-column layout in Word.
Right.
And that's their idea of layout.
Yeah, there's no, you know, you want...
it's a starter.
You kind of look at what some successful game publishers, you know, sometimes the reason the game does well is because the rules are quite digestible. You know, they're broken up, you've got call-out boxes for important points, it's easy to find all the information that you want, you know, the type is not so tightly cramped together that you get eye strain trying to read it and you lose interest.
You have to turn the page to find the chart you need.
Exactly, and you need to be thinking about that when you're doing the layout. So the person may have created a game that is, you know, brilliant and everyone will enjoy playing it. They just have to get over the hump of learning how to play it.
Yeah.
And doing the layout is that's where that can come in.
And that is not to be underestimated. Anybody here who's actually interested in putting your own thing out there, like on your own website, you know, heaven forbid I only hawk the company I work for. But getting a website of your own is cheap. Go through Dreamhost, which is who I personally go through. I don't get any money from them. Yeah, but they're awesome, they're cheap. You can get your own website for, you know, $100 a year, whatever, and put your game out there. Or you can go on something semi-professional like RPG Now, DriveThruRPG.
E23, Paizo does third-party downloads.
There you go. Yeah. There's other alternatives, you know, check them all out.
Games Now, working down.
But the things that will distinguish you from the other, I don't want to exaggerate, the other 30 or 40 people who have a game exactly like yours, and I don't think that's an exaggeration.
Yeah.
Unless
cover first.
Unless you have something that's really out there, like your caveman game. Greg, I'm speaking to Greg. Greg's caveman game that I thought was awesome. We're talking like 10 years ago.
Dreamtime.
That was brilliant. And I've never, it's been at least 10 years since you published that. I've never seen anything else even remotely like that. That was brilliant. But unless you've got something like Dreamtime, if you've got your basic standard fantasy game with, okay, we got these fantasy races, we got, you know, you can do magic, there's going to be, let's be conservative and say, a dozen people whose idea is so similar to yours that the average person won't be able to live apart.
Yeah.
It's just the way life is.
Don't
get your feelings hurt. But the ways to distinguish yourself is what John's saying.
Right.
Have the layout that's comprehensible. Have someone proofread it. Someone who speaks and understands English. Have someone edit it, because you'll take a paragraph to say what can take a sentence. And the person reading it spends a paragraph and goes, oh, God, this is so long and boring. And they don't get to the second paragraph. So they never finish reading your games. They never discover how fun it is. So the layout is huge. Editing is huge. Proofreading is huge. And a big thing, particularly now that the barrier to entry toward distribution is so low, is art.
Yes. Got to be a nice cover.
Got to have a good cover. Because that thumbnail on the website, whatever website you happen to go through, that, as much as the text, is what brings people in and actually has them checking it out. And the interior art is less important, but it has value, because blocks, wall of text is daunting. You know, if there's not something there to splash the people, to give them like a intuitive understanding of, let them imagine what it's like for their character in the game.
Yeah.
And you have to give the eye places to rest.
It's like
reading through a book or a magazine and stuff. Frequently, it's like walking for a long period of time. You need places to stop. If you're like walking down like a mountain trail or something, you're looking for scenery. You're looking for a place to go. Now, that's really cool. How does that relate to this thing about to hit rolls? Oh, okay, you know, and that's, it needs to, it has to be considered when you're doing the final layout, because, yeah, if you just put it all in there as just a Word document and there's no spark to the layout, no one will finish reading it. No one, you know, no one will find out how good a game it was.
Now, there's lots of little, you know, really subtle things. RPG Now, you have flash previews of a lot of the products, which means you can look at the page in this tiny little format and sort of thumb through part of it. So you're not going to be able to read the whole thing, but you're going to get a feel for how it looks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the layout, I mean, it's got to look good at first glance for someone who's making a snap decision on whether or not to buy it,
right,
even if they're going to read the whole thing online.
You have an example, you know, and if you don't have the money for good artwork, interior artwork and things, you've got to find other ways to make it interesting. Putting a texture to the page that doesn't interfere with the readability of it. You know, for me, when Forgotten Realms rules came out for 3.5, I was very, very... I was attracted to the setting. I never played that setting before. I was attracted to it by the way the books looked. They were set up to look like journals, you know, they had sort of they looked like water spots on the pages and things.
Yeah.
And all of the books in that, every supplement that came out had that same look. So you could tell at a glance, you walk into a bookstore or you saw it online, you looked at the cover, you instantly knew that's an FR book.
Mm-hmm.
And that means if I have other ones, that's going to fit right in and probably be, you know, I get the same
experience. And people do judge books by their covers.
One downside of that is all those little wiggly bits in terms of the layout add a tremendous amount of overhead to the memory involved in the size of the file.
If when you're thinking, now you're taking it from an electronic point of view.
For instance, you know, if you do that, you have to be careful to try and do it so that all of these background graphics are like EPS graphics, which you can press down really small,
right,
yet reproduce just fine.
Right, vector art if you can get it.
An entire bitmapped background on every page is just a, you know...
Well, 3 days later, you finished downloading it, you didn't want to...
You never get to read it because it won't open.
Yeah.
Well, that brings me to something from a technical side with the PDFs and things. If you get to the point where you're actually making... You've got some kind of art, good art, bad art, whatever. You know, you've got it laid out. You're pretty happy with the text. You've had it proofread. You've had somebody who actually has a clue how English syntax works go through and edit it. Maybe somebody who actually can write comprehensively. Comprehensively. Write in a way you can understand and want to read.
Coherently.
Thank you. That too. So you got it, right? And you're about to do it. Have a high-res and a low-res version. Have a version that is like the version that you would like to see in a hardbound book in the Library of Congress, and have a version that somebody can load up on their phone. You know, the low-res version, have low-res version of the graphics, low DPI count. Like, instead of being 300, make it like 72.
No.
Instead of being full color, make it... 72 is perfectly fine for a tablet.
This is 132.
Yes, it is. It's also a nice tablet.
Yeah, but the point is, you know,
there needs to be a low end. Also, it makes it more expensive to print when somebody's printing it on their printer at home, which some people still do.
The DPI doesn't make it any more expensive to print.
Okay, that's true. But the color depth, which is the next thing I was going to say. You have like full color, the high res version has full color pictures, the low res version has grayscale.
Yeah,
things like that.
That's important. One of the things I have on most of the ones I sell on RPG now, I have a color version for viewing on screen, and I have a dedicated grayscale version.
There you go. And also, don't just depend on making it grayscale, because something that, particularly if there's text over it, because this is something you mentioned, John, about having text over some kind of texture. Sometimes a black text or white text, depending on how your layout goes, over some kind of picture might be readable to an average person who doesn't have any color deficiency when it's in color, but when you go grayscale, you can't see it anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Well, now you've got black over dark gray, and you can't see it anymore.
Right. I actually have to convert all my colors to different values of dark gray just so they show up on the page.
Exactly.
Light green is like fine on screen, but...
Right. If you have two colors, like a red and a green, that are next to each other, are going to... There's an obvious contrast. Your eye can immediately determine the difference. If you go grayscale, they're going to look like the same gray. Or they can, and you won't note it. You've got to convert it and look at it and go, wow, there's no color, there's no differentiation. It's just one field.
Yeah.
And you've got to kind of learn to anticipate that is likely going to happen. And
PDF development thing for RPG Now.
Yeah,
somebody. Yeah, no. Yeah. But, there's certain values of colors will turn into the exact same gray level. They can be quite distinct colors on screen, and I'm not just talking red and greens and stuff like that. I mean, you can take a checkerboard that looks perfectly good in color and go make it grayscale and turn it into a block of gray. And that applies to your art as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have to go in and sometimes, do all kinds of weird color enhancements on the image, and then grayscale it.
Right. So experiment. Make it right.
And, the other thing is, text with any background behind it, the contrast will be different when it's in color and when it's in black and white. And what is readable in one version could be almost illegible the other way. You have to, for any of these sort of things, you have to think about the different outputs that you're going to create. There's going to be a color version, there's going to be a high-res version, there's going to be a black and white. When you know the ways you intend to produce it, you then are thinking about the ways that when those don't look right. We're going black and white. Well, now if what has been a problem when you print black and white? What, the grays all flatten out and you can't read things. When it's in color, well, he's
an organizer.
He's a staff guy. He's just passing.
Yeah. Another thing is, these are great for RPG books, but you have to remember that something like this, even though it's pretty good size, is only showing your text at about 77% mm-hmm. normal size.
Right.
And so if you're already doing small print for a printed version, it can be really small in this. It turns out these are remarkably legible because they're backlit. You get this huge contrast between the white and the black. Mm-hmm. So even though this was printed for print form in like 10-point text, and it's down to like 8-point on the screen, I mean, I can still read it at arm's length, just fine.
Yeah, and we're old.
Yeah.
So young people.
But for future products, I would probably make the text a little bit larger and pick a dedicated screen font.
You need to worry less about page numbers in the digital version than you do in a print version.
Yeah, because there's no print cost. And the other thing is, on a digital version, you do not need this much white space around the margins. You can... something you have to worry about in print.
Yeah, because you have all that black space around the outside.
Well, no, I mean, you can basically trim the margins down so you have like a quarter inch all the way around instead of a half an inch.
That actually reminds me of something that he said, which reminded me of something. As far as legibility goes, mm-hmm. there is a segment of the... OK, Okay, we're actually talking about like layout and design and the printing process. Are you actually interested in like game design? Yeah, well, it's part of it. Yeah. But I'll finish what I'm saying, and then we can go to something else to somebody who actually wants to talk about like dice and crap. Some of the people who will want to pay for your game can't see it and will only be able to hear it read. So it is extremely important that anything in your game that relies on what it looks like, either you have a way in your standard version to communicate that information, or you come up with an alternate version that has numbers or a description or something. And I'll give you an example. This is a real-life example. There's a game called Icons that I personally think is awesome. It's a superhero game. And it's very, very, very mechanically very simple. The way the character sheets are represented, it has your prowess and coordination and strength and that kind of thing represented by a horizontal graphic bar. And your intelligence goes out to 4, it's a little bar that's 3 wide. And your strength goes out to 9, it's a little bar that's 9 wide. If you can't see that, all you see is intelligence, prowess, coordination. You don't see what it is. You don't see the number. Yeah. Exactly. Because what they hear is someone reading prowess, coordination, strength. And they don't. So something that people who produce supplements for Icons very swiftly started doing was have an accessible version that had actual numbers. In a website I set up for my own game group, because I'm weird this way, I spent an extra amount of time and I made a link for an accessible version that parses the style sheet that I use to make those bars and actually takes the number out of the style name and inserts it as text. So this, the accessible version says Prowess 8. But think about that. When you have something that's graphical, there are people who can't actually see that. That all they can rely on is what is written on the page.
And we're talking about tiny percents of the market, but it's the sort of thing that, you know, if you're doing this all the time, it starts to add up.
Well,
and if you include them, then your market market segment will appreciate it, and you'll get that much more traffic that other people are not getting.
Because you're talking about, yes, it's a very tiny amount of people, but In a world where your game, you know, you make up a game where it takes place in a ring world somewhere, and there's this and there's that. You've, unless you're coming out with something that already has a huge market, say Pathfinder, you're already dealing with a niche market. So the guy that's blind who wants to play your game and read it, he may be like a third of your market. And so make it so he can read your book. That's all I'm saying. Yeah.
I've got a question just about game design in general.
Yeah.
We do that too.
Specifically role-playing games in general. Do we need another system?
That's an excellent question.
Because there are lots of good generic systems out there, like GURPS, or even taking something like Pathfinder.
You know, you say good generic systems.
Yeah,
you say there are generic systems.
Yeah. But there are lots of good systems for determining the challenges and overcoming the situations. When do we get to the point where we don't need new mechanics?
I don't think it's going to happen. Basically, I think that as times change and people's abilities to get together and the way they do the role-playing games changes, they're going to want different mechanics. I mean, there were plenty of perfectly useful systems back in the mid-'80s. I mean, you know, you had your Traveler, your early Champion. You know, any number of things, like GURPS, etc. But we've gotten away from the, you know, 500-page rule books with a table on every page for this special subcase.
Champion still has that.
Yeah, well, GURPS is based on that.
The most recent Champions book, I think, is like 700 pages long.
I picked it up at Gen Con last year. It's, you know, this thick. It stops bullets. But, there are going to be people who continue to play the system they play because it's a system they've always played. Mm-hmm. There are going to be people who are just getting into it and look at something like Hero System that's this thick and go, I don't want that.
Right.
I think as long as people's needs and desires for the kind of system change, there's going to be new systems.
What do you think, John?
I agree with him. I think the game systems, I think, evolve based on, you know, it's sort of a response to what has already come before, where somebody, you know, has been playing the games that, you know, for a number of years and went, I can do better. Yeah, I can do better.
I mean, that's how I think everyone gets
and
into
so
it.
You get the kind of, the meter goes towards more detail, but the people, it's like, the game system, the mechanics are very simple. And for a quick game, you play it a couple of times, that's fine. But if people play it longer, they want more rules for things, for handling more minutiae. And so people then somebody starts coming up with rules for games that cover everything. And then the opposite happens. You get people who start playing that and go, I don't need to roll dice to figure out going grocery shopping. We're just winging it. It's like, you buy bread. We move on to, the gunfighter, the inventing the super death ray or whatever. And somebody creates a game with a lot fewer mechanics. And it's just kind of...
Yeah, or someone comes up with a setting that demands a unique mechanic for just that setting.
Right.
It's like, okay, this is a single-purpose game. All it does is this setting all by itself.
And when that works, that's actually very cool.
Yeah.
When you get a game mechanic that just really suits the setting, Pendragon has some cool game mechanics. You're not going to use them in a superhero game.
Exactly.
But Pendragon works for Pendragon. Really suited for Pendragon. But John, for somebody who you haven't actually designed role-playing games, right?
No. Played a number of them.
All right. For somebody who hasn't actually designed any, I think you hit it pretty much on the head. Mm-hmm. I'm going to call there's two parts to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to build on what you were saying. I'm not disagreeing with you, and I'm not just repeating what you said. I'm building on it.
Do it.
Part of it's what I call the boiling frog syndrome. You can boil a frog as long as you turn the water up really, really slowly. Champions is a perfect...
I want to see them do that on Mythbusters.
Okay. They say you can boil a frog if you turn the heat up really slowly. I don't know if it's true. It could be a complete lie. But it's a good story.
We're going to make a robot frog.
But Champions is a perfect example of this, because I played...
I have the original Champions. It's a little staple-bound book about this thick.
Yeah, I actually never played first edition Champions. Mm-hmm. I started with Champions 2, which is one that was in color. The cover was in color. Champions 1 was in black and white.
Because it was in a color box, though.
Yeah. It was essentially a fairly simple design-your-own-powers kind of game at a time when game design did not have that. It was an era when giants walked the earth. No, it was the D&D. D&D was the thing. And you didn't write up the character you wanted to play. You rolled things to find out what you were going to play.
Right.
That was the world that Champions came into. And as each edition has come out, rules have gotten more specific and more specific and more specific until you've got rolling to see if you can pick up the cup to take a drink of water. So, and you got like an eighth. And every single edition has had more and more pages.
I don't think you actually have to roll to see if you can pick up a cup of water, but that's one of the things.
I'm exaggerating for
no, no, but that's one of the things I actually made a point of in the game. It was like, can you do real world stuff in Champions? I'm going to try and, walk across the street when the light changes,
Yeah.
Critical failure,
I'll use like an actual real example. There used to be a time when if you wanted to fly at the speed of light, to go from here to there.
You bought FTL.
You just bought it. Okay. Now there's like restrictions on when a game written into the rule book kind of restrictions. Can you have FTL and regular flight in the same multi-power? Can you have flight and swimming in the same? I mean, there's this layer upon layer of restrictions and micromanagement of what you can do, which goes back to what John was saying.
Right. And there's some
I want a rule for that. I don't want to have to decide on the cuff whether or not somebody can do that.
There are some
I want the rule book to tell me that.
I've gamed with who want those rules because otherwise they argue about it forever. And you know that some of these rules came up from 3 hours of arguing over, well, I can have the faster than light as opposed to the other.
But these are people who have been the frog sitting in the pot for the past 10 years.
Right.
The guy who walks in the room doesn't want to pick up an 800-pound book and play the superhero game.
Right.
I think the best example of this was the Amber role-playing game.
Yes.
Anyone remember that?
Amber Dice is what?
Yeah. 300 pages of ruleless role-playing.
It was mainly setting and telling you how to run an Amber game. It wasn't really.
I know, but the point is, it's like, I don't need to buy a book that's a couple hundred pages thick to tell me how to not use rules.
I like the take things out, that extra bit of randomness where it's like you've got your great plan, it's just...
It's the gambling
shit,
thing. You don't go into Las Vegas going, I'm going to lose today. You
kill
you to roll the dice.
There's actually a very good game called Wushu. Wushu, yeah. It's called Wushu.
Yeah.
That is essentially the premise of that game is it's not whether you succeed or not because you're playing a game to entertain each other, so you know pretty much that you're going to succeed. The goal of that game system is to make it as interesting as possible. So it's not really task determination whether or not it's successful or not. It's how can you make your success entertaining or not. And it's a different way of looking at it. I haven't actually played it, but it reads really interesting. It's worth checking into if you want to take a different look at the assumptions behind the role-playing games. Take a look at what you... Just go
to like RPG now. You have categories. They need to have a category for off-the-wall role-playing.
It's actually not that off-the-wall in play, from what I've read. No, there's like generally off-the-wall stuff. Noblesse was off-the-wall. There's a game called Noblesse. Somebody I was an acquaintance with wrote a few years ago. That essentially it was, you know, like Amber turned to 11. It's everybody was an incarnation of something. It was if you can find Noblesse, it's awesome. It was available in print back when people printed books, and it's worth picking up if you can find a copy. Your question, which is about do we need more game systems? Here's the deal, and this goes to what you were saying. Different people want different things, and goes to what John was saying. Different people, as they play the same thing, their tastes develop. Generally, I don't think this is always true, but generally toward wanting more detail in what they've already got. So here's the deal with that. These two things are true. I'm not disputing either of these. It also has to do with setting. Because whatever you spend the most of your time in the game doing, that's what you as a game designer, trying to go back to the ostensible topic of the panel, that's what you as a game designer should actually focus most of your time on as far as rules go. Here's an example of that. Icons, I mentioned, is a superhero game. Icons skill system does not exist. There's no skill system. You have your stats: prowess, coordination, intellect, strength, willpower. I'm missing one. Anyway, it doesn't matter. If you have whatever skills your character has. Say you're a scientist. Okay, great, you're a scientist. Say you're a detective. Great, you're a detective. You got detective work. Okay, and you roll whatever your stat would be to do that. And because that's not really the focus of the game. It's something you do from time to time, so there needs to be a rule for it. But it's a superhero game. You spend most of your time flying around and blasting people. Right. Or role-playing, you know, great power and great responsibility. You don't spend most of your time figuring out whether or not you can, you know, open a safe. There's a rule for knowing how to open a safe. It's called security systems. Does your character know that? And that's your choice. Does my character know how to crack a safe? If they do, they do. And they roll whatever their stat was for that. If they don't, they don't. And then you can buy specialty.
Blast it open.
Well, it's a superhero game. You can blast it open. So, and then they have a rule for specialties, which is a way to buy your ability in a particular skill slightly above what your stat for that would be. For example, say Batman has a coordination of 6, but his stealth is +3, so he's godlike when it comes to being stealthy. That's just an example. So it's not actually a skill system per se, but it's just a way of handling something that isn't the focus of the game in a way that doesn't burden you with, like, a core CORPS. It's a game Greg did a number of years ago. You know, like an enormous skill chart, you know, of what relates to what and how much everything costs, which is awesome if that's what the game is about, right. But just an anchor if it's not what the game is about. Right. So it really depends on what your game is about. If you've got a game that's all about skills and being sneaky and being clever and opening safes and things, you don't want to have 500 pages of spells.
That's where the single-purpose system works out. The icons would not work out for a Pulp Fiction, you know, Indiana Jones setting because you have multiple sets of skills. But for superheroes, it does. I mean, if you have characters that need to know 7 different things, icons doesn't seem to be able to handle that.
It up to a point. See, really the thing is, you need... Okay, here's from a mechanical point of view, coming at it as a game designer. And this is specifically for role-playing games. I don't think it's really relevant so much to board games. I don't have a huge amount of experience with board games. I've designed a couple. People play them at Gen Con, they seem to have fun, but it's really not my bag. But for role-playing games, you're dealing with generally somewhere roughly 6 people. And generally they play one character at a time. These are generalizations. There's, you know, exceptions.
Yeah.
But generally that's kind of the parameters you're working under. Your mechanics need to distinguish between those 6 people. You need a way that on paper they look different. so that they each have their niche.
Yeah.
And in the game where everybody's a spy, you need to have some way for all six spies to have their own niche. So that would be, you know, demolitions and fooling people into believing what you're saying.
Your ensemble cast.
Yeah, your A-team kind of thing. You need a way to have those people be different. In a game that's about superheroes, the way they're different isn't, you know, I've got detective works and you know how to open a safe. It's I can fly and have a droid that fires energy blasts, and you're a super strong woman from an island in the Mediterranean, that kind of deal.
Well, this is one of the criticisms of the GURPS, where they only have four attributes, and you arrange the numbers that you can buy that's effective for certain things. Take a party of six players, and any three of them might look the same in terms of their basic attribute abilities.
Yeah. So mechanically, the rules should, and this is my own personal opinion, should be as complicated or as detailed as you need to make the characters in the setting you're writing for distinct, and no more complicated than that. Any more complicated past that, and you're simply adding a burden to the people playing it that doesn't actually give them anything. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
There are people
and
who disagree with me.
What you're saying is true. And if it didn't get the point across directly enough, design to the strength of what you're trying to do with the game. If it's a superhero game, it's about the powers. You know, if it's a Pulp Fiction game, you know, it's about one another thing. If it's Victorian, you've got certain Victorian.
Oh, that's a good point. Like Victorian, you probably have like a whole subsystem, or at the very least more detail when it comes to like social interaction in a Victorian game that you wouldn't have in almost any other game.
I literally have that. I'm working on a Jules Verne steampunk setting,
right.
And
because
there's an entire chapter on, you know, class and race and gender and religion and politics.
Things that, like in a modern game, being the enlightened people we are, we simply assume these things aren't important. So, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So the question originated also partly because I have a friend, we have a friend who was working on designing his own game, and he was asking us to read and play test it and stuff like that, and he worked on it for a number of years.
He's still working on it.
Yeah, that's completely common.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But he got to a point and he said,
I don't need to reinvent
a whole system. What I really want to do is write a setting
and
add a couple rules.
That's why there are generic role-playing systems out there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, my system is generic and with an open supplement license. You want to publish something for this? Be my guest.
Right.
And there are more like that. You know,
yeah.
He just has to go out there to RPG Now or another site, and download a bunch of these suckers,
figure out which one,
find one that works
is.
For him, and then design the setting for it.
The D6, Open D6.
And his
is
really
Fudge.
Yeah.
Savage Worlds has an open license.
Fudge is a good one. I'm not familiar with Savage Worlds' license. I personally don't like their rules, but I know a guy who thinks they're awesome.
So
it really depends on a personal preference thing.
Savage Worlds is a multiple polyhedra. It's like D4s, D6s, D8s, D10s, D12s. That doesn't appeal to me, but I mean, it's a decent system. And their license is like, you know, write us and tell us what you want to do with it, and they'll send you back an email saying, yeah, sure. You know.
Open D6 is released under,
Creative Commons or something?
It's either Creative Commons or it's the one that WotC spat out before they died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, OGL. I think it's OGL. I think Open D6 is OGL, but it might be Creative Commons. But if you look around, you can find something that's close and then build on that. Personally, I think that'd be the way to go. Because if you start from scratch, A, you're creating a barrier to entry for people who want to play. So let's say, Core, for example.
Yeah.
I don't know what the licensing was for that. I haven't looked at it in a long
time.
That
was, based. You had to contact me. I've got a couple of licenses out there for it.
Yeah. Okay. If you had like a crazy detailed spy versus spy kind of setting you wanted to do, and you wanted to come up with crazy... I don't mean crazy in a bad way. I just mean very complicated, you know, skill interaction charts and language charts and things. You can either spend the next 10 years making that up, or you can use Core, and then
or any number of other ones.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm just using it as an example.
Yeah.
But the deal is, if you make up your own, there's going to be like 10 people in the room who want to play your game. Six of them might have played this other game that you could have used. None of them have played yours before.
Right.
So you're actually and. It may not seem like a big deal to you, but here's the deal. It's not really about money, because I don't care what anybody says. If you want to make a fortune in game design, you're not going to.
Right.
So it's about creating something and having other people get enjoyment from it. That's really what it's about. And if you want to have other people play your game, which to me is the real goal, is to have somebody say, hey, I played Legacy. We had a great time. Thank you. That's gold. That's brilliant.
Yeah, that's why people are doing the D&D 3.5s or the Pathfinder or whatever, because so, it's something that everyone had played.
Right.
Therefore, the accessibility.
You don't
was
have
like,
two hurdles to overcome. Yeah.
If they're interested in the setting,
they
already know the system.
They have to learn the setting. If they know the mechanics, it's like, oh, well, now it's a different setting. So now you just have to sell them on the setting, but not, you know, you don't have to sell them on two things, which some people won't have time for, and maybe we don't have time for.
We have 5 minutes. Anybody have any questions? You have an answer. What do you want? How about you, Lady Anderson?
I'm a freelance artist, a designer, and I was interested and I got a lot from listening to you about what different fields are available in that, what different areas I can go into.
As a designer for in the game industry, you know,
in general.
You know, my own layout experience is not actually with games specifically, but you know, it's. But if you're laying out, you know, a rule book, you know, the skills that you would develop for laying out a magazine or any sort of published material are going to be of use for designing a game book. The same thing if you want to keep people's interest. You know, you want the imagery to reinforce what the text is trying to tell you. You know, you want to make use, if artwork is provided, you want to find good places to put it in there, like I said, to provide places for the eye to take a break. You know, if you're a designer, you know how to design for print, you can design anything in print. And, you know, like an annual report to a game manual, it's about understanding what the product is and what the intent is of the person who's produced it, and using your design to help that happen.
Help that message
get across. Yeah. Okay. Know the audience, know the creator, and find a way so that the two of them meet.
And know the medium that you're doing it for.
Yes.
I think one thing I've been thinking of as this conversation's been going on is that rule books for role-playing games are a combination creative technical document.
Yeah, really.
Because the rules need to be clear and accessible, and you need to be able to quickly turn to a page and reference it, whether it's digital or physical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it also has to have that creative aspect of the art and the prose about the setting to get people interested and excited. And that's a challenge.
And it's a work of fiction.
So that's a weird challenge for a document to be both very creative and very technical at different stages.
Right. The crunch versus fluff ratio.
Oh, on a general thing, as far as, let's say you want to, I'm just assuming you want to get paid.
Not a lot, but yeah.
No, I tell you, if there are other ways to make money, if you actually have any artistic ability, that will make you money more reliably than anything related to gaming. It's just a fact. For every Tony DiTralizzi, there's 50,000 people you never heard of, you know, who did this drawing and that book and this drawing and that book, and they've got a whole bunch of all of $300 from it. And that's it. That's all I'm ever going to get.
Gaming is like being a fiction writer, but without the huge pay and benefits package.
I would also suggest you look up Never Met Press, because they actually are paying artists for stock imagery that they will then sell to people who are designing games.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Oh, RPG Now sells stock artwork. People will put together artwork and packages to say, hey, use my art in your game.
Right. Yeah, that's true. They sell actually, they actually
can,
sell
you
pretty
can make
well.
A, you know, a little bit of money off of the individual piece, and you can also get your name out there as an artist to get seen, and then maybe get hired on for a bigger project.
Never Met
Press. Okay. And there's just a bunch of people who online collaborate on making open role-playing.
But yours?
I'll do that.
That's okay. Yeah, I never heard of that. That's actually pretty cool to know. Never Met Press.
They're on Facebook.
There are a number of good, just general display your art sites, like DeviantArt.com.
Yeah, DeviantArt's awesome. I mean,
sell stuff on Etsy.
I've seen lots of art.
Sell prints on Etsy if you want to.
Mm-hmm. Etsy's more for like folk art, isn't it?
It is a little bit more for actual created objects than printed.
Yeah. Like things that real human beings have made.
Physical objects.
In terms of game production, though, you can actually get game components printed through some of these places.
Is that right?
That's cool. I mean, there's the places that do the little three-dimensional printing or laser cutting and stuff like that.
That is going to be the next big thing.
No, I mean, there are places that will sell you the templates or send you... I want to do a three-dimensional Settlers of Catan. And they'll just make you one.
Yeah. With the proliferation of cheap three-dimensional wireframe modeling software, I mean, Google gives it away, you know. And the three-dimensional printing, I mean, that's going to make your own toys and be like the next big thing, I think. But like anything else, the people who
easy
actually...
Easy bake oven, but for game components.
Yeah, but like anything else, the people who actually have the creativity to come up with the designs... will be like there'll be one of those for every 10,000 people who actually want to print.
Yeah, but I think we are at like 9 o'clock now.
Sorry. Yes, we are. Okay.
All right.
Thank you for coming. Thank you,
Brandon. Let me show you.
Tales of the Left Hand. It doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
Not always.
This is going to be out hopefully next week.
You've heard those
ones. But
But
somebody had first going to be a separate download. Yes. It's free of the game. We answered these questions.
Games
and
it's using the bulk of
Victorian stereotypes.
Thank you.
You were invaluable
as a panel. I'm glad because I read this and I thought, I'm really glad game designers. I did a couple of
articles. Did you do one thing for sure? And Brandon is a.
Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed.
I don't walk out without it.
Thank you.
Beating somebody to death.
Have you